Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, May 26, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on recent developments regarding the transition of oversight of the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome experts John Neuer and Shane Tews. More complete bios provided you in the notice of the call, so we'll stop here to preserve more time for their presentations of about 15 to 20 minutes, followed by your questions. With that, Mr. Neuer, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Will. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I thought to get us started, if you would all indulge me, I would provide a little bit of a background history on the legal and technical underpinnings of the Internet and sort of how we got to where we are today and what precisely the government actions are which are being contemplated, where they fit into this overall legal and technical and regulatory structure. So I think it's pretty widely understood and acknowledged, but not totally appreciated, that the Internet began in the 1970s as a U.S. government-funded project to establish a efficient and survivable network capability that would operate outside of the public switched telephone network. The desire was to find a means of reliable communications that wouldn't be dependent upon a single point of failure that was inherent in the public switched telephone network. So rather than rely on a single switched part of the network, the Internet protocol was designed to break communications into packets, which could then seek any available path to their end destination and be reassembled at the destination. For all of that to work, there are a series of discrete technical functions that are collectively referred to as the IANA. Now, while the Internet today represents, you know, trillions of dollars of infrastructure investments made by global private and public network operators, its functioning still relies on these basic technical IANA functions, which were, at the time that it was a exclusive government network, literally resided on a rack of servers in the office of a single computer scientist professor at the University of Southern California. For a complete sort of oversimplification of what the IANA functions are, you can think of it as sort of a yellow pages of the Internet, where every computer in the world that relies on Internet communications has a means to reconcile IP addresses, the series of computer language string of numbers, into recognizable language, i.e., you know, Internet addresses. So, you know, fedsoc.org is reconciled from its computer language string of numbers. Now, in the very early days of the Internet, when only the U.S. government and affiliated universities and research institutions were using the Internet, the system of having the DNS and the IANA functions managed by a computer science professor was satisfactory given the limited small number of institutions and people that were using it. However, in the 1990s, the United States decided to open up the Internet to essentially the world, to any other government and private interest that wanted to take advantage of the Internet. So recognizing that given the massive expansion of the Internet and the massive expansion of the communities of interest who would take advantage of the Internet, the government recognized that the current system of IANA or the original system of IANA would be insufficient. So you can get enormous detail on the thought process on this online. These came through the production of what came to be called the White Paper and the Green Paper, which were produced by the Commerce Department during the Clinton administration, on thinking through what were the appropriate technical and legal constructs to allow the IANA functions to be performed, the DNS to be resilient, and have it be open and accountable to all of the stakeholders who would emerge. So the conclusion of the white paper and the green paper was that we would need to establish a new private nonprofit enterprise that could assume these IANA functions. And that's where the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN, was born. Now, at the outset, the IANA contracts were then issued to ICANN under a series of contracts with the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, which is the agency within the Commerce Department that I used to lead. And our role and the U.S. government's role was in most respects largely clerical and one of stewardship. In terms of stewardship, the expectation of the Commerce Department role was to ensure that this new institution, ICANN, would actually be, you know, survivable and resilient. It would have a legal structure, it would have budgets, it would have redundancy plans, it would have technical competence, those sorts of issues. And the USG also stood in as a, I guess, a steward, for lack of a better word, is the best example. We created an open space for the private sector to take up these issues, to figure out the best means for the various stakeholders to collectively and collaboratively coordinate and organize the IANA functions without any negative incentives or interference from outside parties. And we probably have to stop here for a second, because I do think it's worth noting or commenting on the importance of this decision by the United States to turn over this incredible new capability to the world without any condition, without any interference, without any efforts to create incentives that would benefit the United States from an economic or strategic standpoint. It really is a fairly remarkable event in the history of, you know, economic cooperation and competition amongst nations, and it's one that I think people tend to gloss over and forget about, particularly as people and different entities and interests have looked at the U.S. government's historic role with some degree of suspicion and have sought to replace the U.S. government role with something more multinational or international, and most concernedly, intergovernmental. I think the United States has a track record of credibility on being fair and dispassionate in the management of these issues that they ought to probably take more credit for as we you know, deal with the ultimate future of IANA. But that's an editorial aside. So from the beginning of ICANN and its establishment, it has been the express intention of the U.S. government to ultimately step away from any vestigial oversight role of the IANA. We have always wanted and expected that these roles are best performed by the private sector. They are inherently technical in nature and don't lend themselves to broader policy considerations. So it ought to be in the private sector. And over the course of the U.S. management and oversight of ICANN and the IANA, the contracts between the U.S. government and ICANN have been amended and modified over time as ICANN became a more mature and accountable organization. So fast forward to the most recent developments. The current administration announced last year their intention to allow the contracts with the U.S. government to expire by their terms. And I think that caught some people by some degree of surprise. even though, as I said, the intention has always been for ICANN to stand on its own as a fully independent private sector institution, I think some observers and stakeholders were caught off guard by the immediacy of it. In reaction to that, to those concerns, a broad group of private sector stakeholders with some government input was brought together to come up with a set of recommendations on what would be the kinds of structural legal reforms intended to ensure ongoing accountability of ICANN to its private sector constituencies that would be necessary before the contract should expire completely. The what they call the cross-community working group, which is representatives of ICANN constituents across the world, came together and produced a set of those recommendations. Those recommendations were submitted to the Commerce Department, NTIA, for review. NTIA has announced that they will announce their view of that report by June 10th. And as of today, the contracts between the Commerce Department and ICANN are set to expire on their terms September 30th of this year. Now, the contracts can be expired by mutual, can be extended by mutual agreement of the parties, and it's been extended periodically. And in fact, it has been extended at least once since NTIA made its announcement that it was going to allow the contract to expire. But that's where we stand now. And those are, it's this dynamic that is currently being examined by the Congress and by others. But at this point, I think I'll turn it over to Shane, and she can talk about the specifics of the cross-community working group and some of the legal and technical issues that people are interested in with regards to ensuring the ongoing accountability and inherent private sector nature of ICANN.
Thanks, John. So there are four points that NTIA has said specifically have to be in any proposal going forward. It's to support the and enhance the multi-stakeholder model, and that's important because there's always a concern about there becoming a multilateral model, which is government, versus a multi-stakeholder, which is governments. Then there's maintain the security, stability, and resiliency of the Internet DNS, and that very specifically goes to the IANA function itself and what it what part it has in the network infrastructure. The third is meet the needs and expectations of the global customers and partners at IANA services. That, again, is a insurance that the people that utilize the phone book, as John called it, have the capability to put new numbers in it and change numbers in it, to be overly simplistic. And then the last is to maintain the openness of the Internet. So none of those are specifically legal terms. That has more to do with the rhetoric of what we're asking the multi-stakeholder process to keep in mind when they went forward with this task. And so what they've done is they've split this into two pieces. The cross-constituency working group is working on the ICANN bylaws going forward. A lot of what came out of the white paper was put forward in sort of a soft form that didn't have a lot of legal guidance to it. And what's happening right now is the cross-constituency working group is trying to harden those into actual ICANN bylaws. So there's a lot to be read there, and at any point post this phone call, either John and I'd be happy to walk through that. The other part of it is what is called the ICG, and this gets a less play, but it's the IANA Stewardship Transition Coordinating Group. And what these people do is the actual technical function they're looking at. There's three parts to that. There's the actual domain name, so that's anything dot anything, so .com, .dot, you know, info, .bike. There's the numbering function, which John mentioned is the IP number that underlays that, and then it's the actual protocol parameters, which is managed by the Internet Engineering Task Force, the IETF. And a lot of that has to do with, if you know, you know, they're moving from IPv4 to IPv6, and you know, how do you manage all those things going forward. So one of the challenges that we have in front of us right now is that the cross-constituency working group is getting a lot of airtime in this space about the bylaws, which are very important. What is not getting as much interest is the fact that the actual IANA function itself and how that is managed has yet to show as much interest, and they still don't have a definitive answer on how they're going to do that, except for they want to no longer have the Department of Commerce be part of the equation. So you the question you ask yourself then is, why is the Department of Commerce potentially still, you know, or an entity that does something that the Department of Commerce does still interesting. And that's the trust but verify nature of making sure that any change that takes place in the record is validated along the way. So that is something they're working out through the IANA Stewardship Transition Group, is to make sure that the current construct of how you manage changing or adding new information to the files is indeed, it is validated along the process. And that's where we get into a lot of geopolitical questions about who has access to the records and who has the ability to change the records. So that's the immediate lay of the land. Will, can we go back to you and open the floor to questions?
Yes, thank you very much for those remarks. We're now going to open the floor to audience questions. In a moment, we will all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Okay, again, if you'd like to ask a question, please hit star and then the pound key. While we wait to see if any of the audience members have a question, I want to ask a question to start with here. We scheduled our call in proximity to yesterday's Senate hearing on this issue. Do you guys want to comment on the way Congress has handled these issues?
Sure. So part of the challenge has been that Senator Cruz and Senator Rubio have both taken a strong interest in this and shown concern about the U.S. giving up potentially what some people are considering a property forward into an unknown entity. And so those questions were continued to be asked. But the real key to the hearing was, you know, are they technically ready to make this change, and what are the international potential implications to that? And David Gross did a fantastic job in his testimony, and I would direct you to his testimony to look at the international elements around that. The other person that would be worth reading is his testimony, because it's a great historic background, is Steve Del Bianco. It's 25 pages, but it really gives you the highlights to everything that's going on here. It went for 2 hours. There was actually very strong attendance, which anybody who follows these issues realizes is quite a feat. And I think that there were some good answers, but there's still a lot of things to be proven as to if the U.S. government were to choose to let this go forward and no longer be part of it. They just want assurance that what the Senate is looking for, and the House as well, is assurance that this will not have any irrevocable potential damage on the way the internet runs.
Yeah, the Congress has historically paid surprisingly close attention to this dynamic, given how technical and esoteric it is. There have been, over the years, as I talked about at the outset, that contracts have been modified by the U.S. government with ICANN, but there have also been periodic episodes where foreign governments have been pushing very, very hard for the for certainly the U.S. government oversight role, if not the entire functions of ICANN, to be transferred to the International Telecommunications Union within the United Nations. Now, that drive had largely been driven by countries that are not well known for their support and protection of free expression and intellectual property and economic freedom. So China and Russia and Iran and others were largely the drivers behind that momentum. And in those scenarios, more than once we had unanimous resolutions sent to the Congress, votes for the United States government to keep its role and to oppose any effort to move these functions into any intergovernmental body. I think the time that has been consumed, the fact that the international those international sponsors for an intergovernmental solution to this to these technical questions have been largely rebuffed by large majorities of our allies and people in the international community, our trading and economic partners and our strategic partners, and you know, the most of the world. So the immediate threat of a very explicit governmental takeover, I think, has receded. and it has receded largely as ICANN has taken steps to become more accountable, as the United States has shown a continued intent to eventually close out its oversight. So I think where the Congress is now is much more in concept supportive of the conclusion of this transition, but that support being expressly predicated upon seeing very strong language in the bylaws of this new institution that it remains a not tethered to the U.S. government, but expressly a U.S.-sponsored corporation under the jurisdiction of U.S. laws and not subject to capture or transition in the immediate aftermath of the U.S. surrendering its role. So people have been very vigilant to make sure that whatever the reform structures are, that it will be, if not impossible, extraordinarily difficult for newly independent ICANN to, at some point in the future, reconstitute itself somewhere else outside of the protection of U.S. laws and with a much heavier government influence. So those are the general concerns that one hears from Congress, and I think we heard yesterday, but they are concerns expressed with a openness and willingness that, you know, the old trust but verify, when we have reliable legal structures that ensure that ICANN will remain a private sector entity under the jurisdiction of U.S. laws and accountable to its private sector stakeholders, that's sort of the non-negotiable threshold for the conclusion of this process.
Well, we have a number of listeners on the line here, and all are evidently already experts on ICANN because we are still wide open for questions. If you are not an ICANN expert and have a question, please do hit star and the pound key right now, and we'll put you right on the phone to ask your question. And we do have one now, so we'll go to that caller. If at any time while this caller asks their question you would like to join the queue, we invite you to please hit star and then the pound key. Let's go to that first caller.
Good afternoon. This is Gary Wheaton up here in New Hampshire again. Shouldn't it be important to oversimplify this a little bit? For example, you're saying that this will be privatized as a corporation under American laws. Well, under American laws, a foreign government can buy an American corporation. They do it all the time. So what value is it for the United States to give up the internet? And aren't there inherent risks that are pretty obvious? That's my question.
Sure. Well, the protection of U.S. laws is this is a two-layer protection. The first layer are the bylaws of this new institution that have a series of restrictions and commitments to ensure that the scenario that you're describing does not take place. So under the bylaws, it will be a California nonprofit, and the California nonprofit law protects the members of such an institution and ensures that the bylaws are followed. So it would be under the proposals that are currently in place. I believe it requires a 75% vote of the stakeholder community to change its legal posture in any way. So it's not just the U.S. law as a monolithic entity. It is the specific structure of California nonprofit law and the specific bylaws that are going to be enshrined. Now, there are recommendations, those bylaws that are the recommended changes to the bylaws that are enshrined in this cross-community working group document that is currently under review, you know, are going to have to be reviewed very carefully, and we're going to have to ensure that they are robust and granular enough to make it very difficult for a single entity or for the management of the institution itself to make decisions that would fundamentally change the multi-stakeholder nature of the institution. So, and those are precisely the kinds of things that I think the Congress is focused on, that much of the industry is focused on, that I'm sure that my former colleagues at NTIA are interested on. So it's going to be a combination of not just, you know, well, you're in America, what would keep, you know, Huawei from buying them? It's it's more granular than that, and it's based on both the specific body of law, which is California nonprofit, and the specific bylaws of the institution.
So the intent is to make sure that you have the protection of the U.S. legal system. The concern would be, we were lucky that this all happened in the timing that sending it to Geneva and having something like a FIPA-style coordination and going to a place where you really had no tether to any of the decisions that they made.
Great answer. If I can just interject. So when you say multi-stakeholders as far as performing bylaws, my impression, I don't know California law, but even in a nonprofit, you have a board of directors who can change those bylaws. Whether you indicated a 75% majority, are you talking about all the members, or are you talking about the board of directors? Because the board of directors obviously is more easily infiltrated or influenced, if you will, right?
Right. So the general structure of ICANN is the stakeholders and the constituencies at various levels are tied to the individual IANA functions. So, and this is probably more technical than is going to be useful for this call, but by way of example, one of the IANA functions includes publishing changes to the Internet Protocol. ICANN doesn't produce those changes to the Internet Protocol standards. That's done by a separate group called the Internet Engineering Task Force. They then have representation in ICANN as a stakeholder and have a board representation. The regional internet registries. So another, Shane was discussing the transition from IPv4 to IPv6. This is a dynamic that underscores how recent the history of these institutions and the internet is. Given our initial, the beginning of the internet as I said, a federal government and research and university-led project, we came up with the artifact that the MIT as a university had more IP addresses than China, right? And part of that was a result of these regional internet registries. Now with IPv6, these huge numbers of IP addresses are distributed globally to what they call these regional internet registries. That is one of the IANA functions, and the regional registries have representation on the board and are members. The same goes for the registrars and the registries. So what will be important is, for just the reason that you underscore, to not allow a isolated, unaccountable board to produce these decisions separate from the community. The board itself is representative of the constituencies and the community. So that provides the protection that, you know, you're going to have an overwhelming majority of each of the institutions that collectively perform these IANA functions, which then get coordinated by ICANN, to agree to any significant change.
So here are some of the changes that are in the cross-constituency working group bylaw changes. And this is, again, so the multi-stakeholder group is a bunch of what they call the advisory councils and support organizations. So it's the business constituency, the intellectual property rights constituency. There's two different groups that are basically representative of the civil society organizations as well as the user community. And so they've asked to be able to recall the entire board as a last measure, to be able to remove the individual ICANN board directors on an as-needed or interested basis, control of the periodic reviews, control of the affirmation of commitments, which is what currently stands at the Department of Commerce, veto the strategic plans and budget proposals by the ICANN board, and approve any changes from the ICANN fundamental bylaws that are in the Articles of a Corporation. So they're looking to, again, strengthen and harden these into the ICANN bylaws, where right now they're known, they're in some documents, but they're not actually part of the ICANN bylaw structure.
Yeah, that great answer, very interesting. I believe it when I see it. I guess I'm skeptical. I mean, you know, you look at
you aren't the only one.
You know, you look at large governments, large institutions like the UN, corruption is everywhere. You know, look at FIFA. You know, there's a lot of influence in there.
And that's precisely the kind of outcome that this entire process is designed to avoid, to not allow, in the absence of U.S. stewardship, U.S. government stewardship, to allow the institution to, for lack of a better phrase, get captured by itself or to get captured by any other entities. So all these accountability metrics are there to ensure that it doesn't become a FIFA-like unaccountable organization that controls its own budget, controls its own destiny, free from any real accountability to the member institutions that it is explicitly designed to serve or any other government. So that's precisely what they're trying to avoid. And I believe that the general framework that is enshrined in the recommendations of the cross-community working group are a very, very promising start to that. And with additional, you know, input and contribution from the community, you know, I think they should be successful in avoiding what you rightly identify as the what would be negative consequences.
All right, I'll give up my monopoly. Thanks for the answers.
Well, thank you to our questioner for that interesting exchange there. We did not pick up any more questions during that, so if you would like to ask a question, if you hit star and then pound key and then the pound P, you'll be right at the front of the line. Again, that's star and pound. While we wait to see if we get another question, I want to make a quick commercial announcement. We have another Teleforum call tomorrow that I think may be of interest to many people on the call today, titled, Is the FBI Taking a Bite Out of Apple? We're going to have some experts on the phone to update you on what has happened with that whole saga and what might be coming next. That is tomorrow at noon at this same number. We have not picked up any other questions here, so I'm going to take a quick opportunity to ask one more. For those of us who want to continue following developments here, what inflection points are coming up? What are some big things we should be keeping an eye on as this process moves along?
So the next immediate action point is going to be June 10th, when the NTIA and the Commerce Department is scheduled to announce or release its initial review and judgment on the cross-community working group recommendations. So you can look to, I believe it is www.doc.ntia.gov, or it's just the Commerce Department, National Telecommunications and Information Administration. They will be publishing their reaction, and that will launch the next round of, you know, public engagement on, you know, what people in private industry and each of these constituent groups that collectively make up the IANA, what the Congress, what foreign entities feel about this, and it will commence this process of refining the accountability recommendations. Depending on how voluminous those reactions and inputs are, I think the next thing that you would expect to see is potentially calls for an extension of the September 30th expiration date. I think, you know, we have moved on. There are still people in some quarters who say the U.S. should never give up any of its oversight role. But I believe the broader view at this point is we're probably approaching a point where we're going to be successfully able to do this, but we probably shouldn't be bound by, you know, artificial deadlines. And if we need to consume a little bit more time to make sure this is done precisely right, so that we have the bylaws tight enough that we can be confident in the ongoing independence of ICANN as a private sector institution, we should probably consume that time. But those will be some of the discussions from a process standpoint. What are the specific changes that we need to continue to review? And then from a procedure standpoint, do we extend the time or do we not? But those will be the points of activity over the summer.
We do have one more listener who's rung in with a question here. We'll go to that now. While we do that, I hope that you will also join the queue by hitting star and then the pound key.
Hi, this is Antoinette. I wanted to know, this, I have the campus possibly expect to run in one day, but is it internet ownership regulation under ICANN, or is it about establishing a competitive internet in another country if the U.S. is assumed to have ownership over the internet that currently exists globally?
So ICANN's role is to be the technical coordinator of the unique identifiers of the internet. So their only job, to go back to what John said, is to be the equivalent of the yellow pages. They're just telling you where to point things. They're a directory. And they're in charge of letting people own directory addresses, which they don't actually own them, they lease them. The internet itself is a network of networks, so there's no stop or end point to where the internet begins and ends. There's people that created certain points in it. There's the www part, there's the element of the .com, you know, all the names on there, but there's not one specific entity that has full ownership of the internet. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think at different times people have been concerned about a quote-unquote fracturing of the internet, that if the entities that were dissatisfied with the U.S. role would then have an incentive to set up a competing internet in some way. The reality is, and the underlying strength of the internet and of the single domain name system is that it really only works because everybody agrees for it to work. And you've got people point to IANA and point to ICANN for the coordination of this voluntarily, because that's where everybody else is. There's just sort of consensus around it. That consensus is now so complete to include, you know, many, many, many billions of devices and networks, that the ability of anyone to try and, I mean, like, and there's nothing technically that would stop anybody from creating, you know, I've got my own internet I wish you to point to, but the reality is no one would point there, and why would you want to do that? And so if a hermited regime in some country decided to completely cut their citizenry off from the internet, that would have a significant detrimental impact on the citizens of that country, but it would not have a negative impact on the stability and security of the global internet that the rest of us continue to rely upon. And there's really nothing in what's going on here that would impact that.
Okay, thanks.
We do still have time to take more questions if there are any, so let's make a final call here. This is your last chance to ask a question of our experts, and you can do so by hitting star and then the pound key. It looks like we do have a question. This will be our last unless somebody – oh, we have two, actually. So let's go ahead and work through these two questions here.
Dave Demers, Society member in Berkeley. A couple of very quick questions. About the speaker's perception about China's efforts to create its own sovereign internet. This sort of meshes with your comments just a moment ago, which is kind of a layering, not on top of the fundamental network layer of the internet, but actually imposing firewall connections very extensively to create a different version of the internet. Do you see that ICANN has any role in that process? And my second question has to do with just the nature of large institutions, which generally devolve over time and become fiefdoms and self-serving. I know you've addressed a few mechanisms already to try to prevent that, but assuming that the inevitable occurs, is there a reset button? Is there kind of an override at some point where it's a kind of a revolutionary action to get back to a fresher version of ICANN?
On China and the firewall, there's not much that, anybody who would want the firewall to be taken away that ICANN can do in that. All ICANN runs is the ability to control the write of the dot. So .cn, which is the Chinese country code, is delegated by ICANN. But what happens to the left of the dot, anything around that is, for China to choose, as well as anything that runs through the internet service providers, which are government owned in China. They do tend to filter. So as we all know, most social media that we're aware, we're used to, is not available in China unless you have UVPN outside of the Chinese network. I have a lot of opinions on that, but as far as ICANN's role in that, their only role should be, again, being the technical coordinator of the unique identifiers. The key is not to allow the Chinese point of view that is asking to filter things to become actually present in any of the ICANN policy development process. And that's one of the things that is part of the bylaws, is making sure that what they call the Government Advisory Committee, the GAC, is any government that chooses to join ICANN can have a member of the GAC, and they give advice to the board. But none of the advice has to be committed to unless there is a consensus policy where they specifically ask a question of the board. So unlike the ITU, where it's a one country, one vote, and quite often the U.S. is outnumbered, the GAC doesn't have a mechanism currently, and they're strengthening this to make sure that this does not continue to be a potential problem, that governments cannot in any way come in and be stronger than the rest of the multi-stakeholder process on the policy development process at ICANN.
And, on your second observation about large institutions, I agree with you completely. And I think this is where the details of the bylaws are going to be very, very important, that ICANN at its core serves only as a technical coordinating body, that it receives information and technical proposals from its constituent members, and its role is simply to coordinate them, not for ICANN under its own motion to come up with policy proposals or technical solutions or the kinds of things that would drive that devolution of a large institution. But very importantly, I think this process cannot be viewed as a concluding process. This is very much, the Churchillian end of the beginning in terms of how this institution is going to function. And I think it's going to be incumbent upon each of the stakeholder communities and constituencies to not just say, okay, the new bylaws are acceptable, but to take advantage of the authority and the processes enshrined in those bylaws to continue the reform and management of ICANN so that it becomes, and remains the sort of unexciting, dry technical coordinating body that it was intend to be at the outset, and to be vigilant for any evidence of mission creep and expansion of its role. But those are the sorts of things that the bylaws are being drafted for those purposes. And like I said, this is going to be a process, and everybody who's interested needs to remain interested after this conclusion and view this as the beginning of a new phase where the community is actively guarding against the institutional creep that you reference.
And two other points that I didn't bring up when I was talking earlier about the bylaws, they are going to add the ability to inspect ICANN's internal documents and records, which has been a challenge to date. They redact a lot of the information that is made public by the decision-making process for the ICANN board, so that'll be new. And then they also have the ability to challenge the board's actions via an independent review panel whose decisions will be binding. So those are two new elements into the proposed bylaws.
Well, so we lost our caller with the second question there, and then they rejoined. They may have gotten off to avoid asking their question, but just in case they didn't, I want to give that person a quick chance to enter star and the pound key and get back in the queue here. But perhaps their question was already answered. Do we have any concluding remarks before we adjourn?
No, I think, you know, what I was closing that last question with, or answered that last question with, in terms of I think it's important for anybody on this call who is interested in these issues to be engaged, to look for the announcements from NTIA and the process whereby the final accountability structures are being crafted. And then as importantly, if not more importantly, to remain interested and aware as those new accountability processes are executed upon and put into practice at such time that the USG ever does finally step away.
And the only other thing I would comment is that this is an area of interest to you, that there's also an initiative that NTIA would like your input on internet governance. They have an open RFI right now on how we should be managing another fascinating topic under the ITU, which is the World Telecommunications Standards Assembly, which is 16 coming up this fall. So there is an RFI open right now asking for how we should manage internet governance versus traditional ITU telecom issues. So you might want to take a look at that.
Well, Mr. Neuer and Ms. Tews, thank you so much for joining us today and offering these remarks. Thank you as well to our audience and all our questioners. We hope to hear from a lot of you tomorrow at noon to talk about the ongoing saga with the FBI and Apple. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.